This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This hour, we've been hearing voices from inside Syria and reporters trying to cover the calamity that is taking place there. I visited refugee camps myself, particularly in northern Jordan, in Zaatari. And what you hear as you go from tent to tent is, why isn't the United States doing more? Why isn't it expending its extraordinary military machine to defend us? That's what refugees say. And that's not just the Syrian view. Whether you're a humanitarian or a Machiavellian in world affairs, you can argue that the United States should do a great deal more, should set up safe zones, should help refugees, should maybe even bomb the airports of Syria. But President Obama ran, after all, largely on his judgment that intervention in Iraq had been a stupid war to prosecute. And he concluded as a result that the United States could not go about fixing other Middle Eastern countries, particularly Syria, and it didn't make sense to attack the Assad regime even after it had crossed the so-called red line and used chemical weapons on its own people. I think one of the best people to understand the administration's thinking on this is Ben Rhodes, President Obama's close foreign policy aide, and I reached him in Washington. Now, Ben, the president has said recently that he is haunted, that's his word, by what he might have done differently in Syria. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think, David, whenever you look at the humanitarian situation in Syria, you can't help but be haunted by the enormous loss of life, the tragic suffering that's been taking place there. I think one of the most frustrating elements of dealing with the situation for the present is that we have spent countless hours reviewing options, trying to think through what we can do to alleviate that humanitarian suffering. And frankly, it is just a challenge that eludes any simple or easy solution. And so, you know, we've turned around every military option, every diplomatic option possible. We've exhausted many of those options. But the fact of the matter is, there's such a complex array of forces at play in Syria that it's difficult to find the set of tools that has succeeded in minimizing both the loss of life and the humanitarian crisis there.
So what you're saying is that something like a no-fly zone is something that you've tested and gamed out, and it seems impossible to do without horrific negative consequences. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, on the no-fly zone, you know, first of all, that is not something that has ever been recommended by our military, who would have to carry it out. The fact of the matter is, it would distract resources from the ongoing counter-ISIL campaign. There's no way to put in place a no-fly zone without directly taking on the Assad regime militarily. And taking on, to some extent, their Russian sponsors, given that they are the ones who provide the air defense systems. And frankly, even if you were able to put a no-fly zone over a portion of the country, much of the bombardment of civilians takes place, yes, from air attacks, but also from artillery, from missile launches. So you wouldn't necessarily stop the violence on the ground either. So a no-fly zone might achieve a discrete purpose in a particular area, but it could risk significant escalation without even resolving the underlying conflict that is fueling the violence and the suffering.
Is Syria something that can be put back together again in any way? You now have a situation where the second biggest city for Syrians is the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan. The casualty count is 500,000, 11 million refugees. What becomes of Syria most likely in any possible resolution? And what role does Assad play and for how long?
Well, on the last question, I think we believe that there has to be a circuit breaker where Assad leaves power, that's necessary for there to be essentially a space for people to come together. And that would include elements of the current government as well as elements of the opposition. Look, I think it's going to be a long-term process to put Syria back together again. Tragically, in the Middle East, we've seen similar instances in places like Lebanon and Iraq where sectarian politics led to extreme violence and then gradually led back towards political resolutions that in both countries are still playing out.
So there's an election November 8th. The odds are, if the polls can be believed, that the dominant favorite is Hillary Clinton. And she's been involved with this issue herself, and none of these things are going to come as a great surprise to her. But what possible thing or complex of things can you advise Hillary Clinton, a new president, on January 20th, where it concerns Syria? What are the options that are open to her? What are the possibilities? How does she possibly help bring this to a close?
What we would advise, first of all, is continuing to prosecute the counter-ISIL campaign to its conclusion. We could really break the back of ISIL here in the coming months, and I think that should be continued. I think what also should be brought into this equation, David, is that if you're able to do that, you have in eastern Syria a portion of territory where there is an opposition that can consolidate some control of territory. Those are also oppositionists who could be a part of a potential political solution down the line. The last instance I'd use on this is arming the opposition. We have provided support to the opposition. At the same time, we've been measured and deliberate about it because there are elements of the opposition that are extremist. And when you're a U.S. president, the last thing you want to do is provide arms to organizations that might end up attacking you. So the complexity
and the creation of fighters for the so-called opposition has led to some tiny number of effective fighters, hasn't it?
Well, what we've seen is we've been able to provide the ballast for some of the groups that have been operating in the West. What we've also seen, frankly, in the East is that with U.S. Airstrikes against ISIL, sometimes airdrops of weapons, we've been able to work in a coordinated fashion in ways that exceeded even our expectations. So when Kobani was about to fall, we had essentially an emergency provision of support and arms, but then we were able to push back significantly against ISIL. The fact of the matter is, in other parts of the country, you have a Russian government and an Iranian government that are pouring weapons in as well. And so the ability to simply arm a proxy into supremacy in that environment is not there.
Ben, I've always gotten the sense that part of the political difficulty of the president's position in recent years on Syria is that implicitly he's asking the American people to accept a tragic view of foreign policy and its limitations and of life itself. In other words, we went into Iraq full force, a catastrophe. We went into Libya with a kind of partial force, a catastrophe. Now we're not doing very much at all as a sort of minimalist action in Syria, and it's a catastrophe. And the message that you have to deal with and that the president himself has to deal with is that sometimes a catastrophe is what we have to accept. That's the horror of it, isn't it?
Well, the message is also we have to think very carefully about the use of U.S. military force. Where does it work and where does it not work? Our military can accomplish any mission that we give it in the short term, but the question is what consequences is that going to engender going forward? We get criticized for referencing Iraq frequently, but the fact of the matter is that is not a talking point. That is a reality, that we had 150,000 troops in a neighboring country with a sectarian dynamic, and that didn't stop the killing. That didn't stop a civil war from taking hold there. We recently traveled to Laos, where there are still U.S. bombs mm-hmm. killing children 40 years after that war. So we have to recognize that, at a certain point, the use of military force became the test of whether or not you were serious about dealing with a problem. But the fact is, use of military force isn't always the right tool to reach for in dealing with the problem. And there are not that many examples, frankly, in our post-war history where we have been able to use military force to engineer outcomes in places as complex as Syria.
But now, this is a particularly tough case to make in the American mindset when we speak of American exceptionalism and the biggest and best military force on the planet and in the history of the world. In other words, in the political argument, you hear it in the presidential debate too, it's almost impermissible to make the case for limits.
But limits are essential for America to maintain its leadership. You know, one of the things that I say repeatedly is that without limits, America will put itself out of business as the sole superpower. If you look at history, any understanding of history and what brings superpowers down, it is overreach. And the fact of the matter is, if we continued on the pace of military operations in the Middle East, we would be unable to deal with a rising China, unable to exert our leadership in the Asia Pacific, or to look for opportunities around the world, or to deal with the challenge of climate change effectively. The amount of bandwidth it would take to fully invest in a military intervention in Syria would foreclose our ability to do anything else and would be so resource intensive that it would provide openings to China and Russia and other countries to challenge us in other parts of the world. So that exceptionalism, that leadership is not premised, I think, on the kind of unlimited application of U.S. military force to solve problems. It's about making decisions. And in defending ourselves and defending our allies and ensuring the long-term success of our allies and making a difference where we can on a humanitarian basis, our military continues to be unparalleled. That doesn't mean that they can solve every problem in the world, nor should they be called upon to do so.
Ben, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Ben Rhodes is assistant to the president and a deputy national security advisor.